nobody really wants to be another Cynthia McKinney. You know, they've got this verb. They've made my name into a verb. That person was McKinney. So Bernie and his wife and family have made a calculation that it's better to fight on the inside or to be a placeholder on the inside than it is to be on the outside. The Democrats, every 4 years, want to fashion themselves into a contortionist to trick the people into believing that they really stand for them. But the Democratic policy should be clear now, that the Democratic policy doesn't stand for them, because 25 years ago, when I was trying to communicate to the people exactly the same observations of President Trump, I was called loony, crazy. I was the wrong deliverer for the message. It was 25 years too soon.
Welcome to Business Game Changers. I'm Sarah Westall. I had the privilege of sitting down with Cynthia McKinney and asking her what she thought of the State of the Union address, you know, Trump's speech, and then also the multitude of responses that we got from the Democrats. What did she think of all that? You know, I have my own opinions. I thought it was a great spectacle. I think it was a lot of feel good, setting examples of how to be a good American and how to treat other people. Love that stuff. Love it. But there was a lot of other things that I was disappointed on. I don't know if we're putting America first. And I also don't think we're making a big attempt at, maybe we're making a big attempt, but it sure wasn't discussed at cleaning up the swamp, cleaning up the corruption. I would like to see that more targeted. And then I also thought the Democrats' response was, at least the official one by Kennedy, was a complete waste of an opportunity. That's my position on it. I thought they talked about the same issues that they don't have respect on, and that they could have really got to the meat of the issue and brought people together, but they didn't. And, you know, that's why we're in the situation that we're in. But I wanted to bring in somebody that I could hear the meat from. I could hear an objective, ethical viewpoint. You might not agree with her, but I do know that she's going to be coming at it from an ethical position of what she thinks is the best for everyone. No ulterior motives, no separate agendas, and I wanted to see what she really thought. So let's get into that interview now with Congresswoman and Dr. Cynthia McKinney.
Hi, Cynthia. Welcome back to the program.
Hello. I'm happy to be with you once again. The great Sarah Westall.
Well, thank you very much. I don't know if YouTube thinks that, but I'm so glad that you're going to come and speak to us about what you thought of the latest State of the Union and the Democrats' response. Could you give me your overall thoughts on what you thought of that both speeches, just overall?
Well, actually, there were more than two speeches. So basically what I did was I began to take notes for, I think, three or four of them. There was the president's delivery of the State of the Union address. There was Representative Joe Kennedy's response. There was the governor of Kentucky who was formerly a Republican who switched and became a Democrat. He did a response as well. So that's three responses. And then I have my sort of overall kind of recap, and I have a more detailed, maybe just description of what the president had to say and my reaction to that. So I've broken it down any number of ways, you know, however you want to tackle it, I'm ready to go.
Well, we can tackle each side if you want. I guess Well, I need to refrain from my own opinions on this. I'll give my little commentary later, but I want to know what you thought of the, there's obviously some good points and some overall bad points. The good points, you know, like role models and how to behave as people. It was always good. It's a feel good thing. It's always good for people to hear, and both sides always do it good, and it's a good deal. But the real meat of the issue, a lot of times you have to read into it to understand what they're really saying and, and what their agendas are. And so, you know, I guess my thinking is I would like to see what you really thought Trump was trying to get accomplished. And then, you know, for the, I didn't watch all the different responses. So I suppose each response had a different a purpose and agenda. The main, the official response, I thought, and I want your opinion on that as well. I want to know whether you thought they kind of missed the boat and missed a great opportunity there. But can you first talk about what you thought Trump's, besides the good stuff, whatever, what was his overall meat of what he was trying to accomplish?
Well, first of all, let me just say that the president's delivery of the State of the Union address, in my opinion, was very well orchestrated, well scripted, well performed, and a demonstration of good staff work. So now, you know, I can go a little bit deeper, but superficially, that was my takeaway from what happened behind the rostrum in the chamber of the House of Representatives.
Yeah, I would agree with you. It was a very well orchestrated. They did a good job. But getting past all of that stuff, what was he really, what was the meat of it? What was your takeaway of what he was trying to get accomplished and the messages he was sending?
Okay, well, let me pull these glasses down and get to what I saw and my thoughts. Okay, basically, in my just go through what the president said, if we have the time to do that. Basically, what I did was I sort of dissected this State of the Union address into, it turns out to be 12 phases. So there's the recap of the old and, you know, sort of the fires, the storms, the floods, everything that we know, Hurricane Harvey, all of that. That's the context. So I believe the president wanted to state the context within which he assumed the presidency. Then there's the phase two is the appeal for unity. If there's a mountain, we can climb it. If there's a frontier, we can cross it. If there's a challenge, we can tame it. If there's an opportunity, we can seize it. The State of the Union is strong because our people are strong. Okay, you know, that's the hip, hip, hurrah appeal for unity. The words don't match the deeds. So let's go into the phase three, which is the recitation of the accomplishments. And so now this is where you get, you know, in my days in the Georgia legislature, when bills were being rushed through at the last minute, you know, I'm from the South. And so the Southern legislators would say, well, you know, that bill's got some boogers and hanks in it, you know. And so there's definitely something in there that ain't right, right? That doesn't stand up to too much scrutiny. And so now we're getting to the point where we're going to have to actually study these numbers. We're going to have to study the sources so that we can have confidence that what we heard in the State of the Union actually exists in the lives of the people who are affected by the president's policies. Okay, so we've got the increase in manufacturing jobs by 200,000, the unemployment claims at 45-year low, the gains in the stock market, the 401k pensions, college savings accounts are secure, all of this, the tax cuts. Well, you know, who can say one way or another what the tax cuts are? Even the members of Congress haven't read every page. So who got what in the tax cuts? That's something that we have to study. That's something that we can't just take the OMB's word for. We can't just take people's word for it. We've got to dig down into those boogers and hanks. We've got to, the devil is in the details. We've got to get down into the details to assess whether or not these are really accomplishments or these are straw accomplishments. So that's something more for the investigation. The president said, this is the American moment and you can live the American dream. Okay, so there are many people who are not living the American dream right now, and they expected, I believe, that when they voted for the president, that they expected 1 year out that there would be, or 1 year in, that there would be more change, more transformation, more sort of the campaign promises that the president had spoken long and hard about the system being rigged, lock her up, the draining the swamp, all of the campaign rhetoric, but we haven't seen the swamp drain. The wars are still going on. So there hasn't been enough there. And so I believe that there are some distractions that are keeping the people away from understanding that they ought to be pressing for the there instead of pursuing the distractions. But I'll get into that a little bit later. Then there comes phase four, where he's talking about the future for the U.S., the American way, faith and family are the center of the American way. And the president is big on the police officers and the military, the soldiers and the veterans. But the best way that you can be kind to the veterans is to not create a new generation of veterans who are being mistreated by the VA and mistreated by the government and mistreated by U.S. military policy. That's the way you can be kind to the veterans, but that all gets lost in the sauce. Okay, then there's the phase five was the discussion about appointments and legislation. And so he talked about having the opportunity to appoint more judges to the courts, defending the Second Amendment, restoring religious liberty. We know what that means. We know these are like buzzwords. These are buzz policies that are kind of like red meat for the president's base. And so you give them that. That's always going to have, you know, in a State of the Union, you're going to have the red meat going on. Okay, then in phase six, the president starts talking about the regulations and the actually he had made a commitment, he says, that he would decrease two regulations for every one. Well, this is something that we need to read. We need to understand which regulations are going, which regulations are gone, and which regulations are new, and which regulations stay. This is what, you know, because what I tell my students is that in critical analysis, we have to always ask who's the winner and who's the loser. So before we applaud what the president has to say, we need to know who wins from the policies and who loses from the policies. For example, what I heard, I don't know this, but if this is true, then what I heard is that the tax cuts for corporations are permanent, but the tax cuts for individuals have a sunset and they have to be renewed. Now, if this is accurate, then that means, that definitely means that the reason Apple is coming back, the reason the car manufacturers are coming back is because they got something. And so we need to know what it is. This is just something that we need to know, and that the people who are paying attention to policy, of course, everybody doesn't pay attention to those boogers and hanks. Everybody doesn't pay attention. But when the time comes for those who are not paying attention to rely on those who are, then those who are need to have done this analysis in order to be true to those who have not done the analysis. And we can't just go by what the pundits say. We got to become pundits ourselves, in the very same way that many people in the era of fake news, now many people have become journalists. They have self-fashioned themselves into journalists. And that's exactly what we've got to do for policy wonks as well. We've got to fashion ourselves into policy wonks, and somebody's got to be sitting down, spending the time reading those bills. I like to read bills, but right now I've got 200 students that I need to take care of. And so I need to rely on other people to do some of that work. Of course, I can do, I'm experienced at reading legislation. And so, you know, you take your experience. But anyway, what I'm saying is that we just can't take the president's word for this. And we can't take the pundits' words for this as well. Okay, then fixing the infrastructure. Now, there's nobody who will say that we don't need, with the potholes and, you know, on this recent Unrig, the tour that we did back in September, we went from Georgia to Colorado. We went past Denver. We were headed into Utah, I believe. And then we learned that there were the forest, you know, the fires, and that we wouldn't be able to proceed. But the point is that there was a time when you wouldn't hit a pothole on an interstate. And now the U.S. interstates are in bad shape. So what is the president's position on restoring the infrastructure? He's talked about it, but what he's talked about is privatizing the infrastructure. Well, now that's not going to work, because there is something that should belong in the commons. And one of the things that I believe that made the United States great was these investments in science that belong to the commons, the investments in the infrastructure that belong to the commons. Now, if we're going to go to a system where the profit motive overtakes the good for the country, I think that's a step in the wrong direction. And that's something that needs to be debated by the people of this country, and not just accepting what the president has to say. So infrastructure, you can't tell the people in Flint, Michigan, for example, that we don't need infrastructure investments. For that matter, in my home county of DeKalb County in the city of Atlanta, where people have had to boil their water, where it's unacceptable. It's absolutely unacceptable. And I've seen videos online of people who are able to strike a match and their water from the tap lights on fire. This is unacceptable. What is the damage that's being done by fracking? The president said that the United States is an oil and energy exporter. At what cost? At what cost to the commons? And so how is our future through our children impaired because the water that they're drinking is tainted and toxic? Anyway, so these are legitimate areas where the policy wonks need to get to work. These policy wonks need to be people whom we trust from every side of the political spectrum, from the extreme right all the way through to the extreme left, including everybody in the middle. Okay, then the president talked about from poverty to prosperity. And the fact of the matter is that we're experiencing, everybody's talking about the opioid crisis, but nobody's talking about, very few people are talking about how the special interests got us there. And I've seen some research that has been done about the individual families who have benefited from this opioid crisis. Nobody really talks about what the mission of the U.S. military is in Afghanistan and how we came to have Afghanistan go from zero in terms of poppy production to where it is now. The more the U.S. military became involved in Afghanistan, the higher the poppy production. What's the relationship? And of course, the Kosovo exists as a result of the Kosovo Liberation Army, which were the main drug traffickers utilized by the CIA to bolster Wall Street and at the same time to make sure that the U.S. cultivated, U.S. protected drugs made their way throughout Europe. And in the same in terms of Colombia, making its way throughout the United States. And of course, we know about the DEA relationship with the Sinaloa cartel, making sure that the drugs, the cocaine, had a pipeline straight into the United States from the northern part of the United States. So this is information that we have to have. And so then when the president talks about the drug war, we know that that's bogus talk. And we need to understand what's bogus and what's not bogus. Okay. From poverty to prosperity, the fact of the matter is that for all of these reasons, the bad trade deals, the Rust Belt, the loss of manufacturing jobs, the influx of drugs, not just into the black community, black and brown communities, but now also into the white communities. And so what you're witnessing is the result of this extremely bad policy that culminated in the Obama administration. So the Democrats are as complicit, maybe are as complicit as are the Republicans. Now, the decrease in the life expectancy in the United States. This is something that should be greeted. This is a statistic that should be greeted with great alarm. But we're not talking about it. And so what does the relationship to the lack of delivery of health care to people inside the United States have to do with the fact that in some communities, the infant mortality and maternal mortality rates are just like so-called third world countries? What about the life expectancy that is decreasing in the United States now? So what actually is going on with policy? This is where our policy wants are extremely necessary. And we need to have that critique done from left and from right and everything in between. So this is a call out for me. So you can't talk about the opioid problem without also talking about pharmaceuticals and the individual families that have benefited from loopholes in the law and that sort of thing. The fact that the president also talked about the FDA approving more drugs than ever before. Well, that's not necessarily a good thing, because we know that FDA approved drugs are the cause of a whole lot of the problems. So it's not the approval of the drugs, it's what exactly is. And quite frankly, I I'm in one of those third world countries, but I went to the doctor today and the doctor prescribed herbal medication for me. Now, that just doesn't happen in the United States.
And we need a lot more of it. Keep going. Right. I don't want to interrupt you. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So then, you know, then, of course, my thing is U.S. foreign and military policy. I did my undergraduate studies in international relations, my graduate studies in international relations. And part of that, you know, from the Fletcher School was security studies. So I kind of studied this war thing and nuclear weapons and all that sort of stuff. And but I'm a peacenik, but, you know, you study that, you know, when you don't know any better, you know, and that was like, the best school to go to, Fletcher School. And so that's what, you know, I ended up there. Well, anyway, bottom line is when it comes to U.S. foreign and military policy, the president has failed. And for him to take a credit for what Russia and Iran and Hezbollah have done in Iraq and Syria, I mean, you know, it's just absolutely outrageous. And so, okay, so, you know, you want to be braggadocious and you want to say, okay, we did that. If the United States policy follows what Iran and Hezbollah and Russia did in Iraq and in Syria, it's fine, but it's not. And that is the problem, because right now the United States is at war with its NATO ally, Turkey, inside Syria. So it wasn't enough. And this is because you still have the regime change agenda going on. And I believe that this has everything to do with Israel's policies for that part of the world and not for U.S. first policies that should be quite different if we want to maintain our dignity and our respect. But that's not U.S. policy. U.S. policy, and of course, President reiterated that he had taken Jerusalem off the table. So right now, what I think we're seeing is an Israel first foreign policy and military policy coming out of Washington, D.C., that is little different, some different, but little different than what Hillary Clinton would have done. But I still have to say that Hillary Clinton would have had us already in war with Russia. So, you know, this is not, and let me also just say something about left and right, that terminology. To equate Democrats with the left is specious, because in fact, the Democrats are nowhere near the left. If the Democrats, who are still led nominally by Hillary Clinton, because that's the way the structure of the party works, is that the Democratic nominee is the titular head of the party. So the Democratic Party is still under the leadership and guidance and, quite frankly, ownership of Hillary Clinton. And so therefore, she is not the left. Now, let me just begin to wrap this up. Then, you know, President talked about the pilgrims and freedom. That's a little bit more red meat, right? Because in my opinion, some people have never been free in the United States, and that's because of the pilgrims, right? I can go directly to the Native Americans and the decimation of their effort to fight back. And we're even seeing that now with policies, Bureau of Land Management policies about the indigenous population in North America. So pilgrims and freedom, that's just red meat for the president's base. Now, the State of the Union response by Joe Kennedy. I have seen a lot of the, you know, one of my tweets, I put that the president had populated his administration with people who have big wallets and small minds. And I think that's still, unfortunately, the case. So we can see that with the attack on Joe Kennedy, where, you know, the man just put too much chapstick, I guess, on his lips. Now, you know, but what about the substance of what he had to say? And, you know, I don't so much disagree with the substance of what he had to say, but I just think that the Democratic Party has lost all credibility, and therefore whatever is put forward by Democrats as a remedy for the people of the United States basically is not going to happen. It's political theater, because they had their chance and they blew it. And so therefore, you know, I don't think they had multiple opportunities to demonstrate that they were committed to transformational change, and they failed to do it. Chuck Schumer. And then when Bernie Sanders, I'm going to get to Bernie. So then you've got Stephen Beshear, who did another State of the Union response for the Democrats. He's the former governor of Kentucky, who used to be a Republican and then became a Democrat and was able, according to him, to achieve remarkable success by bringing Democrats and Republicans together, and was able to make Kentucky succeed. Okay, so if that's true, now what I noticed about former Governor Beshear is that he exactly fits the demographic of the people who don't vote for Democrats and who did vote for Trump, who the Democrats want to attract in 2018 and then again in 2020. So he performed a demographic, he fulfilled the demographic need of the Democrats. And so that's why he was chosen to deliver the State of the Union. This is what I wrote. I said, I agree with him that the U.S. political system is broken. Thank goodness he didn't mention Russia in his remarks, but Representative Joe Kennedy did. You know, it's kind of, you know, so that was a good thing. But now, here's what, again, what I wrote. The fact is the intelligence agencies, the executive branch, the legislative branch, the judicial branch, the military, and the media are totally rigged. That was one of the things that Trump said. We know now that they're rigged. We've got language to describe it. When I, 25 years ago, when I was trying to communicate to the people exactly the same observations of President Trump, I was called loony, crazy. I was the wrong deliverer for the message. It was 25 years too soon. But maybe we could have nipped it in the bud if people had listened 25 years ago. So we're 25 years late. The system is rigged. But here's what I wrote. Those interests own those special interests that have rigged every part of our system own both the Democrats and the Republicans. Thus, While much of what Bashir says might be true, the Democratic Party bears absolutely no resemblance to the solution, thus remains mostly irrelevant. Those were my thoughts. Then let's get to Bernie Sanders. I know I'm going into a lot of detail on this, but Bernie Sanders, now he delivered the response. That was a response. The unfortunate thing is Bernie endorsed Hillary Clinton. And so therefore Bernie is not even in a position to lead the policy initiatives that we all know and want. He is in no position because the Democrats would not allow him to become the minority leader in the Senate. His job is chief sheep herder. That's what he is.
But why do you think, and I need to ask you this question, why do you think he goes along with all that? Because he completely discredited himself. Now he has no credibility.
Well, I think he went along with it because, look, nobody really wants to be another Cynthia McKinney. You know, they've got this verb. They've made my name into a verb. That person was McKinney'd. And so Bernie and his wife and family have made a calculation that it's better to fight on the inside or to be a placeholder on the inside than it is to be on the outside. That, quite frankly, is the calculation that has been made. And so that's why Bernie had the opportunity to run as an independent. The Green Party begged him, take our line. So it might have been possible for us to have some kind of fusion politics going on. Maybe, I don't know, maybe the first time in U.S. modern political history. But he chose not to do it. And that's a strategic choice for Bernie. Now he's got he's got one of those super PACs, and, you know, he's sort of been brought into the fold. And I have to admit that being in the fold is a comfortable place to be. And so being in the fold, but you have to give up something. And so what he's decided to give up is the fight. So Bernie is not going to fight. He will deliver a message to us, but he's not going to fight that fight. That's up to us.
Okay. So do you think the Democrats overall missed an opportunity to bring, to discuss the meat of what Trump is trying to get accomplished, and we're talking more superficial, or do you think the other speeches are meant to do that?
Well, you know, I've got something. Let me just get back to my notes here, because this is I think key. The Democrats are talking about the immigration system. The Democrats have known ever since I was in Congress and my constituent services, I had to deal with the immigration system. So 25, 30 years ago, we knew that the immigration system was broken. Democrats have done nothing to fix it, even despite having at one point majority in the House and in the Senate and the ability to fix it. But they didn't. They used immigration as a political line to bring in more votes rather than solve the problem. And so now what exactly have the Democrats staked their political presence on? It seems to me that they have staked their political viability on individuals who violated the law. Now, I have a position on U.S. foreign policy that would say, let's withdraw from Latin America, let's withdraw from Africa, let's have respectful engagement, let's withdraw from Asia, and instead adopt respectful engagement. And actually, I'm about to write a paper about what does respectful engagement look like. So if the United States did this, I attended a conference several years ago in Mexico City where the theme was, we don't want to have to immigrate. But you so messed up our country, we have to immigrate. We have to leave our loved ones, leave our community, leave the country that we love in order to try and live because you've so totally destroyed our country. So let's take the chokehold off of the rest of the world and allow the rest of the world to breathe. Because right now, the rest of the world is like Eric Garner. They're yelling, we can't breathe. Now, then, so immigration reform means also foreign and military policy reform. It's a total package. But what the Democrats have staked their political presence on is those people who felt by hook or crook they had to leave their loved ones and come illegally into the United States and stay. Now, I don't think this is a very tenable position for the Democrats to have. So everybody can break the law and get and then come to the front of the line. Well, now we already know that that's what the Democrats stand for because that's what Hillary Clinton and the Clinton Foundation have done. And there has been no justice there.
Well, why do they stand for that? Because we know that it's rhetoric. Because the actual policies aren't doing anything for them. So why is it all just to get voters? I mean, why do they stand for that when their actual policies don't? It's just for voting purposes?
That's what I think so. If the special interests can do, I had a way that I put it in my acceptance speech for the Green Party nomination back in 2008. And it was something like the Democrats and the Republicans, but from the Green Party side, it's mostly the Democrats. But the Democrats want to contort themselves sort of like that circus character who can knot himself and herself in many different ways and bend over backwards and do all of that. That contortionist. The Democrats every 4 years want to fashion themselves into a contortionist to trick the people into believing that they really stand for them. But the Democratic policy should be clear now that the Democratic policy doesn't stand for them because the Democratic Party has been overtaken by these special interests that want war, more income inequality, privatization of public assets. That's exactly what the Democratic Party wants. And Obamacare is not about health care. Obamacare is about health insurance. Healthcare is about taking the insurance employee out of the doctor-patient relationship. It's about taking the banker out of the professor-student relationship. And the Democrats stand for that. And they are not going to change it because those who are getting campaign contributions are getting those campaign contributions from the people who are dictating the policy. That's kind of like a bottom line. Now, I want to say one more thing.
Keep going.
Two more things. This thing about Q and the Q drops. So when we joined each other, I was just catching up on the Q drops. And I'm saying to myself, this is an anonymous individual or group of people or whatever. And there's a community of, you know, Make America Great people who are just all into this. And I'm saying, you know, like, okay, if it's real, it's fine. But I'm not going to stake anything on something that I can't touch, something I can't feel, somebody or bodies that I can't touch and feel. I need to see the policy. I need to see the implications. I don't need to see breadcrumbs because, quite frankly, I told the truth a long time ago. And what I said a long time ago about vaccines, and I mean, you name it, you go right down the list of the issues and policies that I protested 25 years ago. And it's as much or more than whatever is going on now in that part. But, you know, it's just that I was not the right deliverer of the message. And so, therefore, you know, they've taken up. My conclusion is this, and that is that the Obama Kool-Aid also comes in a Trump flavor. And there's a whole lot of people who are drinking the Trump flavor. There are still people who are still sipping on the Obama flavor. But, the question is for people like us who are not imbibing. So we're sober. And how can we still need to be able to come together. That's why your show is so important, but at the same time, your show is under attack because you're bringing out the voices of those who are sober and not on the Kool-Aid.
Well, and I noticed that, you know, my show, anytime a show starts to take off, it's immediately killed. And they're suppressing my numbers and my subscribers and everything. But I noticed that there's certain topics that they'll just let go. They won't suppress. And Q is one of them, which bothers me because that gives me an indication that when YouTube doesn't censor something, it starts to bother me because the people who are heavily censored are the ones that are really objective and really trying to figure out what's going on.
Yes. So, you sent me a screenshot of the, so you've got data now.
Mm-hmm. I do.
That you are being suppressed. Now, that's very interesting. I mean, that's really, really interesting. And so then we need to look at who's not being suppressed. You bring out a valid point. And here's the sort of the last notion that I thought about as the president was delivering his State of the Union address. And that revolves around the whole incident of the spying on Trump in Trump Tower and the whole unmasking and that whole scenario. And Trump was outraged that this had been done to him. Yet Trump signs legislation that allows it to be done to other people in the U.S. It's the height of hypocrisy, and it's the height of privilege. And at the same time, the outrage about, oh, they're trying to kill our president, oh, they're trying to do this, oh, the FBI did that, oh, the FBI did that. The bottom line is that this is not anything new. It is not. And all one has to do is read the COINTELPRO papers. Read, I'm still upset and angry about what happened in the 1960s that's documented in the COINTELPRO papers. So Senator Frank Church, in the intelligence reports that were written in 1976, outlines the illegal uses of intelligence agencies for political purposes inside the United States. This is nothing new. So I look at this outrage that's happening now, and I say, okay, so some of it is because people legitimately don't know. Other parts of it is because people just didn't care. It was people like me who were affected, and so they didn't care. And so, again, I get back to the point of, if you don't stop it when it's happening to me, it is going to come to you. So please care about what the United States government is doing to me. Please care. Because if you don't care about what happens to me, I guarantee you they will come and do it to you. And that's what's happening now.
I think that's a really, really good point. I want to make one point about the immigration thing, because it's become just the hot button on what's going on. And I think we're in a situation where we have the only people that are allowed to come over, the ones who are willing to risk their lives in a very dangerous trek into our country. And those are the ones that we say can then now be left alone and legal. That's the situation we have. We're in limbo land. So the question is, the ethical...
They come over in a very dangerous trek and then are mistreated when they get here.
Yes. And, well, it's a combination of being mistreated because they can't, they don't have papers, and it's, and so they got to be in hiding. While there's the other side who's giving them, you know, they're getting free services and everything else. So there's this dichotomy of weirdness going on. But the problem is, okay, so we either shut our borders down completely and make it secure and make it more open so that people we want to have come into this country well-skilled, because we can't get the skilled people in. You know, we have this, we're shutting down everything right now, and the only ones we have in are letting in are the ones willing to go on this dangerous trek. So those are the people who are really down and out, which some of them, I know a lot of them, they work really hard and they're great people. And then there's also that whole criminal element, okay? So we have this limbo land where we don't have a closed border, but yet we don't have an open border. I mean, we have to do one or the other, either close it or open it, and then do policies. Right now, we're hurting everybody.
Well, yes. My ideas on the comprehensive immigration reform, like I said, also entail changes in U.S. foreign and military policy.
I agree, yes.
But I witnessed through my constituent services the brokenness of the system, where if you want to do things legally, then say, for example, what the president talked about was the chain migration. I've seen cases where it took a dozen years to bring the grandparents over. You know, I mean, you know, it's just unbelievable for family reunion.
It's so just it's not honest, is what you're saying. Well, that statement is not an honest statement.
Well, you mean when he talked, well, he said eliminating chain migration was part of his policy proposal. And I would say that the whole immigration situation is not honest, because if you want to look at it holistically, what function do extremely low-wage workers perform in the United States? Now, part of the reason, I have long said that war is the U.S. energy policy and undocumented immigration is the U.S. labor policy. So basically, you've got the influx of workers who are willing and able to survive and send remittances home on almost nothing. And so the wages in the United States are what? Almost nothing.
Well, and they're below minimum wage in a lot of cases, right? Because they're being taken advantage of.
They're being taken advantage of. Absolutely, they're being taken advantage of. And at the same time, the function that they serve is that you've got this atrophied population. And it's not really atrophied because it doesn't have the potential. It's atrophied because it has been systematically excluded. That atrophied population that I'm referring to is the African American community. Now, Catherine Austin Fitz has something to say about Democratic policy was to switch from reliance on the black vote to reliance on the Latino vote. So now this is a whole different thing that's going on, and you have to talk to her about that. But there's also some strategic reason why why the Democrats have not done anything on immigration. There's also that political dimension as well. But the practical effect is that the larger community has said, okay, we've got this detritus over here, which means the black community, and we want to keep it. Remember, threat is means, motive, and opportunity. And so you want to keep them without the means, without the opportunity, in order to become a threat, either an intellectual threat by dint of the fact that if you allow them to have education, great education, then they begin to compete with your children, and you don't want that. So you have to maintain the privilege, and so you got to keep them low. That's basically what happened in the South, is that, and Lyndon Johnson made reference to this, but that there were certain jobs that no matter how much education the black man or woman had, they just couldn't have that because those jobs were like, for example, driving the trash truck. The driver of the trash truck was always white. And the guys who were picking up, and then this is after 64 and 65. So, there was this hierarchy. And so that is very real. But now that even doesn't exist because of, sort of the trade and all of that sort of thing now. And you get the despondency in the white community like that has existed for a very long time dealing with this kind of treatment, maltreatment in the black community. So the corporations who hired and came to rely on these low-wage workers, those corporations were rarely punished, even though it was against the law for them to hire these workers. So you see, we've got everybody benefiting. Like I said, we need to look at the system from top to bottom, who benefits and who loses. And this is the critical point, and this is what I think the Trump administration misses. And that is, if it is U.S. first and you want to put the people of the U.S., their needs and policy priorities first, then it's education, it's healthcare, it's transportation, it's infrastructure, it's jobs. And job training, he even talked about in the State of the Union, talked about job training and vocational education. But that cannot be along a color line. And that's the problem with the Trump administration. They have not reached out beyond the big wallets and the small minds. They got to do better on that.
Don't you think that if we objectively and people before parties and we come together and solve problems, that yes, we would be surprised at how much people come together from all different areas and don't realize they agree with each other once you get rid of the rhetoric and you get rid of the BS that separates us?
Well, you know, I read the research, there are some professors who are labeled like, you know, white supremacist or whatever. I read them. I read their research because I want to know what they're thinking. And like, you know, I give you the story about the Klan and me having to sit down with the Klan because I'm from South. So that's where the power in the power cells. From the unrigged, the power cells. And so I haven't given up on the power cells, but I have to keep my, you know, I can't do it full time. And I get pulled in so many different directions, like writing, you know, professors have to publish. And so I've got a book coming out, by the way.
Yeah.
And yeah, so
It's difficult, isn't it, to get everything that you want to get accomplished. I really think that, you know, solving a lot of these problems is by getting these parties out of the way and really looking at people. They're cramming everybody into two parties and making everybody think alike. It's essentially we're not a free, decentralized, using everybody's brain. We're centralized control to an extreme at our political levels. And so we're not allowed to actually solve these problems in the most effective ways.
You know, and George Soros is paying people to do the opposite, to pull apart. And so it's a shame that I wouldn't be able to do the power cells full time because, quite frankly, I'm going to be honest with you, I've gotten a lot of interest in the power cells. And I have one, the last American vagabond. He said, I'm going to call you and do an interview with you every month to make sure you're on track with the power cells because we need it. And we need it from somebody who is balanced. I read, I don't know how to pronounce it, Christogenia. Those are the Christian identity people. I read them. I read, you know, I just am in it for the knowledge and in it for the ability to work with everybody and say, and you're absolutely right that, and here's the thing, the power of the power cells is that we utilize the behavioral sciences, action research, the mirroring process, the fishbowl process, things that we know work from total quality management and corporations. We know these things work. And so now we do the same kind of 360 degree involvement But the goal is whole system change for our country. What could be more noble and more patriotic than that?
Amen on that one. So what do you see for 2018 based on everything that you're hearing and seeing?
Well, I tell you what I wish. I wish I had been able to, it's already 2018 now, you know, so if we had been able to do the power sales in 2017, the power sales would have produced candidates for public office. And then we would have candidates coming out of that process, and then they would be able to break out of that. So you would have Democrats voting for Republicans, Republicans voting for Democrats. Because in the end, if you come out of that process, it doesn't matter what your political party is, because your goal and your base is something else.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I love you, Cynthia. I feel we are so blessed, and I hope you keep at it. You stay involved as much as you can. I think people need, we need this. We need some people that help bring people together, look at it objectively. People before parties. Love that.
Yes.
Love that.
Yes.
And thank you so much. This is the meat that I wanted to hear after these that I didn't think we got. So I really appreciate it.
Well, I'm glad. It took me a long time. I apologize. But, you know, in order to do your question justice, I wanted to go through and, you know, let people see where I was going. Honestly, let me tell you something. You're important to me, too, because I believe the most instructive interview that I've ever done on how our system, one of the ways in which our system is rigged, was that interview that we did when the legislation was passing while we were on the phone talking.
Yes, that was very powerful.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, it was censored, but it was very powerful. And so if people haven't, I'll put a little link here so people can get to that one. Yeah, yes. Thank you. Thank you so much. And thank you for sticking around, fixing all your internet stuff and getting it to work and making this whole thing work today.
Yes. Okay. Well, thank you so much. Bye. Love you. You are my sister.
Yes, we are sisters.